Okay, we've been going through the book of Deuteronomy, roughly a chapter a week, and we've come to chapter 19. So I'll read chapter 19 of Deuteronomy. When the Lord your God has cut off the nations whose land the Lord your God is giving you, and you dispossess them and dwell in their cities and in their houses, you shall separate three cities for yourself in the midst of your land, which the Lord your God is giving you to possess. You shall prepare roads for yourself, and divide into three parts the territory of your land, which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, that any manslayer may flee there. This is the case of the manslayer who flees there, that he may live. Whoever kills his neighbor unintentionally, not having hated him in time past, as when a man goes to the woods with his neighbor to cut timber, and his hand swings a stroke with the axe to cut down the tree, and the head slips from the handle and strikes his neighbor so that he dies, he shall flee to one of these cities and live. Lest the avenger of blood, while his anger is hot, pursue the manslayer and overtake him, because the way is long, and kill him, though he was not deserving of death, since he had not hated the victim in time past. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall separate three cities for yourself. Now if the Lord your God enlarges your territory, as he swore to your fathers, and gives you the land which he promised to give to your fathers, and if you keep all these commandments and do them which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to walk always in his ways, then you shall add three more cities for yourself, besides these three, lest innocent blood be shed in the midst of your land, which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, and thus guilt of bloodshed be upon you. But if anyone hates his neighbor, lies in wait for him, rises against him and strikes him mortally so that he dies, and he flees to one of these cities, then the elders of his city shall send and bring him from there and deliver him over to the hand of the avenger of blood, that he may die. Your eyes shall not pity him, but you shall put away the guilt of innocent blood from Israel, that it may go well with you. You shall not remove your neighbor's landmark, which the men of old have set, and your inheritance, which you will inherit in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. One witness shall not rise against the man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commits. By the mouth of two or three witnesses the matter shall be established. If a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who serve in those days. And the judges shall make careful inquiry. And indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. So you shall put away the evil from among you. And those who remain shall hear and fear. Hereafter they shall not again commit such evil among you. Your eye shall not pity. Life shall be for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. All right, as we've studied this middle portion of Deuteronomy, I've mentioned several times this view that Deuteronomy is structured by the order of the Ten Commandments, and we saw in the preceding chapters an emphasis on authority, so the judge, the king, the priest, and then at the end of chapter 18, the prophet. And that makes sense in terms of an explanation of the fifth commandment, because honor your father and your mother has to do not just directly with the parental authority, but with all authority. So it would make sense, if that understanding is correct, that the next topic would be the sixth commandment, thou shalt not murder or thou shalt not kill. And that understanding fits with the beginning of chapter 19. It seems fairly clear that this has to do with the what we would call the sanctity of life. And we'll come back to exactly what that would mean. But this opening part of the chapter clearly has to do with matters of murder and how you're to differentiate between murder, what we would call murder or premeditated murder, and what's often called manslaughter, although the use in the Bible of the term manslaughter is not necessarily equivalent to our American legal use. So it seems clear that there's some connection in the first part of the chapter. I'll make some comments as we go on. You know, removing the neighbor's landmark, what does that have to do with the Sixth Commandment? Not so sure, but we'll see when we get there. In any case, it's fairly clear that the first part of the chapter does have to do with the questions of the value of life and how God wants the land to be kept pure from blood. We'll see that reference later on, and it's an important part of the way this is to be understood. So my plan today is really to focus on the first 13 verses. I will try to comment briefly on verse 14, which is really a section by itself, and then the last part of the chapter also. But I want to focus on the first 13 verses. It's a very closely connected and a very helpful section in terms of our meditation on God's law, and as we'll see also on the salvation we have in Christ. Okay, so the first 13 verses probably strike the first-time reader as rather strange. I mean, so here we have this system in the Bible. We have a reference to an avenger of blood who is going to get the guy who killed his family member, probably, unless the family member makes it to this, unless the murderer or the killer slayer makes it to this city of refuge. Okay, it does, on first glance, look rather strange, especially if you're not haven't read the context or the other references in the Bible before. But this is a means of, I guess, what's called judicial asylum. This is a way in which a person who is accused of a serious crime can find refuge until the question of the crime is settled. And in particular, of course, it has to do with manslaughter directly. Now, there are other references to this in the Old Testament. We've already noticed in Deuteronomy 4 a reference to three cities which were established on the other side, the east side of the Jordan River, before they entered the Promised Land. Exodus 21:14 refers to someone who goes to the altar, and I'll come back to that, and seeks to be safe for his crime there. But the most extensive treatment is in Numbers 35, and we'll actually look at a couple of references there. So if you want more background information on the cities of refuge and the where actually the phrase city of refuge is used, it's not used directly here, then Numbers 35 is a good reference. Then in Joshua 20 and 21, where they actually conquer the land, the assignments of the city of refuge is given. Like, this is that, you know, this is a city of refuge and this is a city of refuge. So those are some of the references if you want more information. So first, let's look at some of the details. What is the basic prescription here? And then we want to step back and ask, what is the meaning? What does it communicate, and as well as what does it point forward to in terms of Christ? So some of the details, as I mentioned, there are three cities appointed east of the Jordan. So before they entered the Promised Land proper, you will, before they crossed the Jordan River and encircled Jericho, there were three cities appointed. If you're keeping track, they were Bezer, Ramoth-Gilead, and Golan. On the west side, and this reference would be in Joshua and elsewhere, there were three cities appointed, Kadesh, Shechem, and Hebron. Now, the narrative says when the Lord enlarges your territory, you need to add more cities. There's no historical record of their ever doing that. In fact, sadly, as with many of these laws, there's no historical record of their enforcing the original injunction here of having a city of refuge. It says that they were appointed, but there are no descriptions of how that actually happened in practice. Well, Lord willing, come back to a couple of cases of people clinging to the altar illegitimately, but that's the basic geography of it. Now, how would they decide where they were to be? Well, there are a couple of factors, but notice in verse 3 in particular, it says, you shall prepare roads for yourself. That's the translation in the New King James Version. The phrase in the Hebrew is a little bit hard to translate. The idea, whatever the translation is that these cities are to be accessible. So it could be that the phrase actually means that they are to be uniformly distributed, distributed in such a way that they would be accessible, or it could have to do with actual construction of roads. In the later Jewish writings, there are specific details that the road is supposed to be this wide, it's supposed to be maintained, and there's supposed to be clear markers saying, you know, city of refuge that way, like those old, you know, signs with the hand and the fingers pointing, that sort of thing. That's supposed to be the way it was. It was like an interstate, okay, to the city of refuge. It was supposed to be easily accessible. And those were, of course, later Jewish traditions, but the text does make it clear that the person should be able to flee there fairly easily. And it was intended for use in the case of accidental manslaughter. Okay, I'm going to have to use a phrase like that several times, so let me explain. First of all, of course, there are no accidents ultimately. God is in control of all things, but the example that's given here in verses, especially in verse 5, is probably the most helpful thing to understand what happens. The fellow is out in the woods. He's cutting with an axe. The head slips from the handle and he kills someone who's nearby. Okay, we would call that an accident, not because we deny God's providence, but that's just a reasonable term to use. But it's not simply the accidental aspect of it that's important, and that's why another reason why the phrase is not as helpful as it might be. There can't have been a long-term feud so that the guy, you know, sort of wiggled the head before he went out there and made sure he was close to his neighbor, you know, and he got him, but it looked like an accident or something like that. There's supposed to be an investigation, and that's implied here and again spelled out further in Numbers 35. It's supposed to be a careful inquiry, but the case that's given here in verse 5 is what probably should be called accidental manslaughter. Okay, it's a case of a man killing another man, but not intentionally, and it wasn't like he hit him and didn't intend to kill him, but he still intended to hit him. It's not that sort of thing at all. It's a rather different situation. And again, the legal codes of different countries have different approaches to manslaughter and distinctions from homicide in general, but we'll stick with that phrase. Okay, so it's intended for the case of accidental manslaughter. That's when the man should seek refuge. Why does he need to seek refuge? Well, because there was this pre-existing system, the Avenger of Blood. Okay, that sounds like it could be the title of a movie or something like that. So the phrase Avenger of Blood is actually the same phrase in the Hebrew as is translated elsewhere, Kinsman Redeemer. Okay, so you think of the Book of Ruth. The Book of Ruth, the kinsman was there to help in whatever the circumstance was, often financially if the person was in straits. It's a goel, G-O-E-L is the way it's transliterated. But here, it's probably, again, a near kinsman. But his duty is not so sweet and endearing as that in Ruth, right? He's supposed to get out and enforce the law on the person. Now, it's not clear that the Avenger of Blood had a free hand. The reason that's given in verse 6 that especially the person would need to flee is that the Avenger of Blood might have his anger hot. Okay, so it's not as if the expected condition would be that the Avenger of Blood would always catch him and just kill him on the spot, but, you know, things happen like that, and so that's the point here. In short, God is here regulating what's probably an existing institution. They had a rather decentralized form of government if you had an Avenger of Blood running around like this, and this is some way of putting order in that. I'm not suggesting that this is a good method for us, but it certainly made sure that justice was seen to, because there was someone who was particularly interested in the case. So there's a reference there to the Avenger of Blood. Now, if in fact the murder was premeditated, and if in fact there was hatred before time, and you can see that in verse 11, a reference to that case, then it will do the killer, the slayer, no good to flee to the city of refuge. Okay? So it's not as if this is a refuge for every case of homicide. If, in fact, someone had a grudge, if there was an intentional murder that took place, well, the person might flee there, but the case would be carefully considered. Again, Numbers 35 has more details about this, and that person would be found to be intentionally killing the other would be put to death according to the law. Now, one other point that I want to bring out, and this also is from Numbers 35, and that is that the person who was able to stay in the city of refuge didn't just go home as soon as the Avenger of Blood calmed down. That person had to stay there until the high priest died. Whoever the high priest was, however old the high priest was, you know, whether he was about to keel over or not, the person who had committed this manslaughter had to stay in the city of refuge until the current high priest died. Okay. So there was, you might say, some sort of house arrest, city arrest. There was certainly some restriction on his movement. And in fact, if he left the city, then the Avenger of Blood could go after him. So there was certainly an incentive for the person to stay where he was supposed to be. As I said, this seems like sort of a strange law, seems like a strange situation that's described, but the intention of the law and what we should learn from it, so now I'm turning to the meaning, first of all, is that it emphasizes how much God places value on the image he has put in man. It is an emphasis then, in terms of the current phrase, on the sanctity of life. Life is sacred insofar as God declares it to be. And just to see that spelled out using scriptural language, let's turn to Numbers 35, toward the last part of the description there. So Numbers 35, so keep your finger in Deuteronomy 19 or whatever, but I guess if you're using a Kindle, it's not your finger, is it? But anyway, what should I say, Logan? Keep your bookmark. There you go. So come up with some generic term. Thank you. Numbers 35, verses 33 and 34. So you can see, if you just scan the previous part of the chapter, there are quite a bit about this same law. Here's the reason why this should not happen, and specifically why there's to be no ransom given, even for the person who only committed manslaughter. It says, "So you shall not pollute the land where you are, for blood defiles the land, for no atonement can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. Therefore do not defile the land which you inhabit, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, dwell among the children of Israel." So there's this concept repeated here and elsewhere that the people could defile the land they live in. I mean, we know the ecological movement, and we think about pollution and that sort of thing, but the biblical picture is that man's sins pollute the land. The sins of the Canaanites polluted the land, and it vomited them out of the land. And here, their sin, in particular the sin of murder, which is not atoned for, defiles the land. The blood that is shed defiles the land. That's the picture that's given here. And that's in connection with this law. And in connection, actually, with the manslayer, the innocent, you might say, manslayer leaving before he should leave. Even that would cause the land to be defiled. And why do we care about the land being defiled? Well, that's in verse 34, because I, the Lord, dwell among the children of Israel. So it's a way of emphasizing the fact that it's the holiness of God which is behind this, and that the shedding of blood is polluting the land in which God dwells, and therefore is an offense against God and cuts them off, you might say, from the presence of God, because they are viewed to be defiled and living in a defiled land. So you can go back to Deuteronomy 19. In larger terms, in terms we might be more familiar with, and as I've already mentioned, in the beginning God made man, male and female, in his own image. And in Genesis 9, that reference didn't make it on the board. I don't know how I did that. Anyway, in Genesis 9, it says specifically, in terms of murder, this is after the flood, that whoever sheds the blood of another man, his life has to be taken, because God says, "I made man in my own image." So an attack upon a man is an attack upon God. That's the picture. And the blood defiling the land is another way of getting at that same idea. It's that human life is dear to God because men are made in the image of God. Now, the striking thing about this is that that applies even in the case where the act isn't a criminal act. So the slaying of a person unintentionally, by accident, is still seen as a serious thing in the sight of God. Right? Think about it. This whole chapter in Deuteronomy, or the first part of the chapter in Deuteronomy, and that whole description in Numbers is there basically to cover a case that we would say is not a crime. But God treats it very seriously. And I thought maybe since Matthew Henry is a lot more eloquent than I am, I would read what Matthew Henry says about this. He refers to the British legal description of what happens here, which is actually based on a French word. My French is terrible, so I will just translate it into accidental manslaughter. But he says, "Thus would God possess people with a great horror and dread of the sin of murder." So he's saying that's the purpose of this, to possess people, to teach people to have a great horror and dread of the sin of murder. And here's the explanation. "If mere accidental manslaughter did thus expose a man, surely he that willfully does violence to the blood of any person, whether from an old grudge or upon a sudden provocation, must," and here he quotes from Proverbs 28, "must flee to the pit and let no man help him." So just think about the way the chapter describes this. The person who has committed manslaughter has to flee for his life. He has this avenger of blood chasing after him. That underlines the seriousness of what happened, even if he wasn't culpable criminally. And the fact that he has to stay in the city of refuge until the high priest dies underlies the same thing. It wasn't a minor thing that happened. All of this is given to tell us the significance of the life of the human, and underline again the importance of the sixth commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." Now, of course, the passage also emphasizes the seriousness of deliberate murder, of a violation that is legally culpable, and that's the description here, that the person would be put away and be killed. But even in the case that we're talking about, there is a need for the people to realize the seriousness of sin. In fact, some people have interpreted the end of Numbers, those verses that I read, as saying that there has to be blood to atone, even in the case of accidental manslaughter. So whose blood is it in that case? Well, some people say it's the high priest. His death atones, in a sense, for that. That's only by the shedding of his blood, by his death, that the person is able to go free. I don't particularly want to press that point, but the whole chapter does underline that significance. But just one other comment along those lines before we think of the New Testament application of this, and that is that it's striking that the Hebrew word for kill or murder in the sixth commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," sorry, "you shall not kill," we normally think of that as equivalent to murder, which is true, but it's actually the word that's used in Numbers 35 for the case that we're talking about here, for the case of an accidental manslaughter. I'm not saying that God is treating that as a sin in the same way, but it does underline the connection between even the premeditated murder in the case we're talking about here. Now, it's all fine to talk about murder and the significance of murder, but I think most of us are not involved in murders. When we go door to door, that's the standard answer, right? You know, "Are you going to heaven?" "Well, I never killed anyone." So we should applaud. That's good. And that is good. I mean, life is sacred. I'm not trying to make fun of that. But the scriptures always try to get at the heart of the matter. And before we turn to the New Testament and complete Matthew Henry's quotation, let me just underline that by looking at verse 9 of chapter 19. So we saw this when we looked at the first part of Deuteronomy. God wants our heart commitment. He doesn't simply want us not to kill. He wants us to love God and love our neighbor. So here in the context of the enlarging of their territory and the provision for more cities, in verse 9 it says, "If you will keep all these commandments to do them, which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to walk always in his ways." So here in the middle of a description of murder, God says, keeping my commandments means loving me. Of course you're not supposed to kill people, but ultimately it's about loving me. And that's the heart of the matter. And then in terms of the New Testament outworking of it, So I didn't read the whole of Matthew Henry's comment. He goes on to say, yet the New Testament represents the sin of murder as more heinous and more dangerous than even this law does. And he quotes from 1 John 3:15, everyone who hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. So try that going door to door. I never killed anyone, but how about hating your brother in your heart? Or how about each of us searching our own hearts and the malice that is referred to in terms of our intentions, whether we actually go through with the crime or not? So this chapter drives home not only the significance of killing and murder, and it is a sobering thing to think about the blood in our own nation that defiles the land, but it also points to matters of the heart and the need to love one another. But in terms of the way this points to Christ, and I've tried to do this as we go through the book of Deuteronomy to think about this, it is a striking thing that the connection here between the cities of refuge, there's a connection between the cities of refuge that are described here and the altar that's mentioned in Exodus 21, the first reference I put up there. Apparently, at least originally, the altar was a place where people would flee for refuge, for sanctuary. I'll come back to that word. But as elsewhere in Deuteronomy, they face a different situation, right? If you have to flee all the way to Jerusalem before the Avenger of Blood gets you, you're going to be in trouble. So instead of having the altar as at the central place of worship as the refuge, it seems that the intention is that there will be provision for more. Three on the west side, three on the east side, and more elsewhere. But the altar is actually referred to as the place where a couple of men seek refuge, illegitimately, I think, but this reference did make it up there. 1 Kings 1 and 2, Adonijah and Joab. It didn't help Joab at all. He was put to death. But there seemed to be a sense that there was a connection of fleeing to the presence of God for safety and security, and that the cities of refuge were an extension of that idea. That's perhaps underlined by the fact that these cities of refuge were also were taken out of the Levitical cities. Okay, so this topic hasn't come up in Deuteronomy, but among the cities, among the division of the land, there were supposed to be certain cities set aside for the Levites. And this, all of the cities of refuge that are chosen from among those cities. And there are references to the high priest, as I already mentioned. So the passage seems to make us connect the presence of God, and especially those dedicated to the worship of God, with this seeking of sanctuary. Now, let me just make a comment. So historically, this was enforced in England, for example. From early on in England until the time of the Protestant Reformation, it was possible to seek refuge in a church, okay, or even within a certain distance of a church. And the law was not a biblical law. It was more based on a pagan law, because even if you were a murderer, you could still seek refuge there, and you wouldn't be put to death, okay? So that's where the word sanctuary comes to have a separate meaning, like seeking sanctuary, seeking refuge, because they did seek refuge in a place of worship. Now, is there any actual connection in the Bible made? Well, I would say, generally speaking, yes. God is referred to several times as our refuge. We flee to God to safety. Psalm 46:1, we sing, you know, God is our refuge, and God is our fortress. In particular, let's look at the book of Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 6. That reference did make it on the board. Okay, Hebrews chapter 6 and verse, the specific verse is verse 18, but I want to back up and read a little bit of the context. I'll back up to verse 13. After just giving them a rather stern warning, the writer to the Hebrews encourages them, and then he says, "For in verse 13, for when God made a promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no one greater, He swore by himself, saying, surely blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply you. And so after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise. For men indeed swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is for them an end of all dispute. Thus God, determining to show more abundantly to the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath, that by two immutable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we might have strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold of the hope set before us. This hope we have as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, in which enters the presence behind the veil, where the forerunner has entered for us, even Jesus, having become high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. So in particular, the verb in verse 18, we have fled for refuge. It's actually just the verb to flee, but the verb to flee has in it the sense of fleeing for refuge. I mean, there are various reasons, I suppose, one might flee, but the verb actually that's used here is the same Greek word as was used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament in Numbers 35, of fleeing to the city of refuge. So it makes sense to have that nuance of meaning. So a lot of commentators see in Hebrews 6:18 an allusion to the cities of refuge, or at least the practice of fleeing to the altar that's mentioned in the Old Testament. Owen's commentary on Hebrews, as you might expect, it's a multi-volume, he's got a fairly good discussion of this. Now, it's possible to overread this, okay? It's possible to overinterpret it and to go on and on about it, and then you come up with us only committing accidental sins and somehow, you know, fleeing to the altar. Well, you don't want to do that, but it is clear, first of all, that the connection involves the fact that we are fleeing from something. We're fleeing from wrath and certain destruction. That's the whole point of fleeing. And second of all, that we're fleeing to something. And it's clear that the refuge we have is in our Savior, the Lord Jesus. We have a hope that we lay hold on. And that hope then, in the metaphor, changes to an anchor of the soul. But it ultimately points forward to our hope in Jesus having opened a way into the presence of God, if you will, giving us sanctuary because he shed his blood, the blood that would defile the land, the blood which we needed to shed of our own so that we would die for our own sins. He died himself in our place. So I hope that's a helpful image. I don't want to press it and say the cities of refuge are some sort of a type of Christ, but it is a helpful reminder to us that our sin is a serious thing before God. We are doomed to die. But God provides in his mercy a refuge, just as here in Deuteronomy 19, he provided mercifully a refuge for the manslayer. Otherwise, he was, as we say, dead meat, right? I mean, the guy's going to catch him and he's going to be gone, even though he didn't legally deserve to die. So from this passage, you can remember not only the preciousness of life in the sight of God, but also the mercy of God to provide salvation through Christ when we deserve, in fact, to die. Okay, so I said I was going to take most of the time of the passage. I did. Any comments or questions on this? Yes.
So manslaughter called an accident, but sometimes a crime still today.
That's right. Yeah, that's why I said that our legal code in England and in America doesn't really correspond exactly. Usually when people talk about manslaughter, it's culpable. So there's a crime committed. And this is not considered a crime. But I didn't know what other phrase to use. Yeah.
Was the Avenger of Lent, was he somebody in the family of the victim, or was he actually appointed that?
It seems that it was a family member because of that, the kinsman redeemer idea. It seems like it was normally a family member who took it on himself to enforce justice. It's not clear that it was, you know, it wasn't like he went out and lynched the guy necessarily. He might have grabbed him by the collar and taken him to the place of justice. It's not spelled out. Of course, it's probably not clear what happened always, but it's probably a member of the family. And this is the sort of thing that still goes on in certain parts of the world. There are blood feuds, and, you know, you get my guy and I'm going to shoot one of your guys, that sort of thing. Or stab him or whatever. Yeah. But it probably was a family member. Yeah. Okay, well, let's then look at the last part of the chapter. I said try to go quickly over this. Verse 14. It's a section by itself. It refers to your neighbor's landmark. Okay. So they didn't have fences the way we do. They certainly didn't have GPS and, you know, some clear demarcation that you could look up somehow about where the boundary was. And the commandment not to remove the neighbor's landmark is basically a warning not to take someone else's land from them. Okay, not to defraud them by taking their land. And it would have been easier because they simply had these stones every once in a, you know, every so often around the land to mark where the land was. Now this commandment occurs elsewhere in the scriptures. I put up a reference in Deuteronomy 27:17. So that's actually one of the curses later on in the book of Deuteronomy is for moving your neighbor's landmark. Maybe more helpful is the references in the Proverbs, and in particular, the connection is made to the poor and the defenseless. Here you would be tempted to take advantage of them and encroach on their land, and it would be even more damaging for them. And so that connects with what we saw earlier in the book of Deuteronomy about the need to show mercy as opposed to stealing from those who are defenseless. Now, it's complicated by the fact that in the land of Canaan, the land was distributed, you might say, permanently, right? Each tribe was allocated a certain amount of land. And so to move the landmark was, in essence, to go against what God had given to them. So that even in the Jubilee, if they had lost the land, somehow they were to be restored to it. But this would be some way of getting around that, a permanent reallocation to yourself of your neighbor's land. And that connection with the Lord your God giving you is explicit in verse 14. What does this have to do with the sixth commandment? I'm not really sure that I know an explanation. I think, I see a general trend in going through Deuteronomy and moving through the commandments. One commentator did give the example of Naboth. After all, he lost his life so that Jezebel could have his land. It's kind of a tenuous connection, but people do get hot under the collar about where their border is and about taking care of their fences. So that's as brief a description as I'm going to give of this. Sorry, hope no one has this as their favorite verse. Let's move on to verses 15 through 21. 15 through 21 is actually connected indirectly, I think, with the discussion earlier, so we can economize a bit. The first part of the section talks about the need for multiple witnesses. We discussed this earlier in Deuteronomy. You have to have two or three witnesses to convict someone. It's something, as we discussed then, has made it into common law. It seems it makes sense that that should be the case. But the special emphasis and the special development in these verses is on the case of a false witness. Okay, so this has to do with perjury. You're under oath. You're bearing witness. Let's say it's a trial, someone's on trial for murder, okay, because it mentions life for life as one example. Someone's on trial for murder, you come up to bear witness, but you lie. You lie with malice, trying to get the person convicted. Okay. What do you do in that case? Well, there's a provision here where the person who is falsely accused can, in turn, accuse the witness of perjury. And that's the context here. Is that explanation clear enough? So, especially if you're being lied about and your life is on the line, it would make sense that there should be some provision for you to say, no, that account is not true. And that person, in fact, has a grudge against me or something like that. I'm going to accuse the witness of dealing falsely. That's what this is about. And it says, in particular, verse 17, there's supposed to be a careful investigation. The phrase here may not be so clear in verse 17, but this is an allusion to the higher court we studied early in Deuteronomy. It wouldn't be a local court. There would be reasons why that wouldn't work as well. But instead, they're supposed to stand before the Lord, So at the central place of worship that God would establish, there would be this highest court we talked about before, sort of like a supreme court, but it wasn't a court of appeals in the same sense. The reference to the priests and the judges is consistent with what we saw in that earlier reference. And they were to make a careful inquiry. Why does it need to be so careful? Well, because of the consequences. Because if, in fact, someone testified falsely and with malice to try to get someone convicted of murder, but in fact was testifying falsely, then the false witness would be put to death. Okay? That's a sobering thing. Whatever it was they had planned in their false testimony to happen to the defendant would in fact happen to them. That's what it's saying. If the witness is a false witness in verse 18 who has testified falsely against his brother, and then verse 19, you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. Now this is supposed to have a social effect. This is supposed to put away the evil from among you, and those who remain shall hear and fear, and hereafter they shall not again commit such evil among you. It's a disincentive to lying on the stand, okay? This is a reason why you would want to be very careful about what you said to someone in court, because you yourself could be, if found to be lying, and I think the implication is lying with malice, so trying to get the person convicted, then you could be held liable for the same penalty as the person originally was to be held liable for. So it's actually interesting to step back from the chapter and see there are a couple of reasons why these laws were to be enforced. One is in terms of justice itself. And the U.S., you know, that idea of justice has sort of fallen on hard times because people tend to want to put God out of the argument. But justice ultimately in the sense of an offense against God that has to be put right. And that's really the emphasis in the first part of the chapter. But here in the last part in these verses, there's an emphasis on the effect it would have in society. The enforcement of laws will cause people to pay attention and to be careful. You know, people who study crime and enforcement of crime, you know, there are all kinds of arguments about why crime should be enforced and the intention of punishing a criminal. Is it merely remediation so that the person will get better? Or is it to make the society better? Is it to keep the society pure? Is it so that justice will be done? Well, the Bible has in mind several of those. I wouldn't say remediation is at the top of the list, especially not for capital crimes, but it is clear that God has placed, especially in at the end here, an emphasis on the need to communicate to the whole of society the seriousness of perjury. Okay, so another footnote. Sounds like the ninth commandment, right? Thou shalt not bear false witness. I suppose if you connect it with the murder that does refer to life for life, then it ties in with the sixth commandment. I'm not going to press the point. But that's a discouraging, therefore, of this bearing false witness. Now, the last verse in verse 21 is a call, not to pity. Okay, we've seen that reference before. The judges are supposed to enforce the laws, whether they have a personal interest in the case or whether it seems just difficult for them to do so. Their eye shall not pity. And it's life shall be for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Okay, I'm sure you're familiar with this phrase. It's usually shortened to eye for eye or tooth for tooth. This is the law of retaliation. Lex talionis is the Latin phrase that's used with it. And it has to do, we should remember, not with this horrible cruelty that is usually associated with, but with a limitation. Right? You can't go beyond this. This is a limitation on the punishment that it could be enforced. And that's a corrective against the sort of avenger of blood when his anger is hot attitude toward enforcement of crimes that might actually take place in societies. No, this is a just God who gives us just laws, and you shall not exact a penalty that exceeds the crime. Okay, so if you hum tunes from the Mikado about the punishment fitting the crime, well, it actually that is the point here. The punishment should exactly fit the crime. Now, let me just make a comment here about the way this is referred to by Jesus in the New Testament. And so let's actually turn there to Matthew chapter 5, just to, for one of the references that made it on the board too. By the way, the lex talionis, the eye for eye, tooth for tooth, a couple of other places, Exodus 21, Leviticus 24. But Matthew 5. So you remember in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus, after saying that he is there not to destroy the law, but to fulfill it, goes on to give several cases in which he explains the law and, as on my understanding, the perversion of the law by the Pharisees. So, for example, verse 21 of Matthew 5, there's a reference to murder, and then Jesus says, but this anger and hatred are also serious offenses against God. So that's the general flow of the chapter. And then in verse 38 of Matthew 5, you see, and you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Okay, so that would be alluding to these references in Exodus and Leviticus, and also the one we just looked at in Deuteronomy. So what is Jesus saying here? Is he saying that it's illegitimate for the civil magistrate to exact life for life? Is he putting aside capital punishment and all sorts of enforcement like that? No. Don't know if anyone's surprised by that. Probably not. Jesus is talking about personal relationships. Jesus is saying that you are not to take vengeance for yourself. And people pervert the law, which in Deuteronomy 19 clearly has to do with a legal situation and a judge, clearly has to do with a court of law. People pervert that and say, that guy got me and I'm going to get him. He cut me off in traffic and I'm going to cut him off. It is specifically addressing interpersonal relationships. And Jesus says, as he always does, that our hearts should be oriented toward loving God and loving our neighbor. So that the application of what Jesus says is not to, you might say, is not to overthrow the law in Deuteronomy 19, but it does help us to understand the law, because everyone involved in a civil case still has the opportunity to hate where hate is not called for. It does touch on our attitudes in every situation, and Calvin in particular points and emphasizes this, that even the judge himself, when he acts in a just way, has to act in a way that respects the law of God and respects the love for neighbor, which is part of the law of God, though the law of God compels him to enforce justice. Okay, I don't know if that was a question you were going to ask, but I tried to anticipate the question. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. I think it's Jesus is not talking about overturning the legal system, but is getting at the heart of the matter, as he always does for every situation. Any comments or questions about that part or the chapter as a whole? No. Okay. Don't know if I lost you guys. Okay. All right, let's close in prayer.